Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. It was evolution versus creationism during a high-profile debate in Kentucky.
How could there be billions of stars more distant than 6,000 years if the world's only 6,000 years old?
Contaminated water is still a hot topic in West Virginia, and we have a primer on testing it.
I can take a sample and collect that and get a number.
Regulating gas drilling has been a concern for a long time, and there are lessons to learn from the past.
So there's been some attention to this, but I think the problem has been that they haven't been enforced.
And it's a good year to pick up the sport of snowshoeing.
How are you doing so far with the snowshoes?
I think I'm doing okay. Yeah, oh boy, just slid a little there. Yes, spoke too soon.
All right.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Bill Nye, the Science Guy, took a trip this past week to debate evolution and creationism at the Kentucky Creation Museum. As Kentucky Public Radio's Devin Katanyama reports for NPR, Nye faced off with Ken Ham of Answers in Genesis.
Jonathan Ryder is a Christian who says he used to watch Bill Nye, the Science Guy, when he was a kid. At the same time, he was attending private school.
So I was being taught one thing at school and then hearing his stuff on his show, which is totally different. So made me really think, okay, I really have to choose what I'm going to believe.
Ryder chose to believe creationism and that the world was made in 6 days, as the Bible says. And psychologists tell us he likely won't change his mind, since our minds like to reinforce what it already believes.
I believe it's the creationists that should be educating the kids out there, because we're teaching them the right way to think.
Ken Ham argues the creationist belief is more likely than evolution because humans weren't around to observe the evolutionary process. But he says the Bible tells the story of the earth. Bill Nye says that's no substitute for science and says science requires predictions based on our understanding of the world, like calculating the time it takes starlight to reach Earth.
There are billions of stars. Mr. Ham, how could there be billions of stars more distant than 6,000 years if the world's only 6,000 years old?
Evolution is the scientific concept that Nye and a majority of scientists agree with. It's also being taught in schools. And when you get older, studies show the more education you have, the less likely you are to believe in creationism. Will Gervais is a psychology professor at the University of Kentucky. He studied the relationship between evolution and religion and says it's tempting to look to a higher power on complex issues.
That's kind of a trick of how our brains work. But the more and more we learn about the world, the more we're finding that our intuitions, as compelling as they are, they're not always right.
What, if anything, would ever change your mind?
That's CNN's Tom Foreman asking Ham a question from the audience. Ham didn't say he would ever change his mind, but instead simply replied he's a Christian.
The Bible is the Word of God. I admit that that's where I start from. I can challenge people that you can go and test that.
While the arguments were respectful, Nye repeatedly asked for evidence.
We would just need one piece of evidence. We would need the fossil that swam from one layer to another. We would need evidence that the universe is not expanding. We would need evidence that the stars appear to be far away, but they're not.
Some experts who study how people think don't expect any winner or loser from Tuesday's event. Michigan State University professor Rand Spiro says the real question this raises is, are children being taught to think critically?
We wonder why kids get out into the world and they can't apply the knowledge from school in the world. It's because the world isn't like what we do in school. The world is more complex. The world doesn't go in a line. It's not organized in chapters. It doesn't have a single right answer.
Back at the Creation Museum, Calvin Perry from Ohio says he believed in God until he started taking science classes in college.
The concepts that the Earth could only be 6,000 years old didn't make sense to me and everything I learned about evolution.
At the same time, Jonathan Ryder says he's currently taking college science classes and says while the class debates have been heated, it's not enough to change his beliefs.
Are you still open to changing your mind?
No, not at this point.
For NPR News, I'm Devin Katayama.
The debate between Nye and Ham received international media attention. Meanwhile, those behind the museum are continuing to work toward funding a planned amusement park that will feature a life-size replica of Noah's Ark. As Kentucky Public Radio's John Hingsbergen reports, some have questioned the timing of the face-off with Bill Nye, the Science Guy.
Since it was announced nearly 3 years ago, the $150 million project has been stalled by a lack of funds. In fact, $37 million worth of tax breaks from the Commonwealth are about to expire. Prior to the debate, Creation Museum founder and CEO Ken Ham responded to a question about the timing of the debate and its relationship to the funding deadlines. According to Ham, there is no relationship. In fact, he says the debate came about following Bill Nye's posting of a YouTube video claiming creationism is not appropriate for children.
And there's been 12 months of back and forth, because he's a very busy man, and obviously you have to, if you're going to do a debate, you have to agree on a topic and so on, so that takes time. So this has nothing to do with the funding of the Ark.
The Creation Museum founder says no one expected the debate to go viral as it has. Ham points out that he and his organization are unable to talk about current funding efforts due to regulations as well as instructions from bond underwriters. The Louisville Courier-Journal reports Answers in Genesis needs to sell another $29 million in bonds by Thursday to avoid triggering redemption of $26 million already sold. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm John Hingsbergen.
Kentucky's health insurance exchange, Connect, has topped 200,000 enrollees, according to the governor's office. Those without insurance have until the end of March to sign up for coverage or face tax penalties. With that deadline approaching, Connect is reaching out to an important group of people, young invincibles. They are uninsured and between 18 and 30 years old. Kentucky Public Radio's Whitney Jones has more about why Connect officials are targeting this young, healthy group.
Wyatt Sievers is a 30-year-old artist and teacher. His pit bull boxer mix Parker enthusiastically welcomes anyone who comes into Sievers' woodshop behind the Murray Art Guild. The floor is covered with sawdust, and a project he's working on for someone in Knoxville sits unassembled on his work table. Sievers is too old to be covered by his parents' insurance, but he wasn't in a hurry to get coverage.
I've just paid for my doctor visits as I've needed them, and I don't catch the cold but once every couple of years. I've been putting it off until the deadline, and I had to, so I did. And it worked out good.
It's worked out because by selling custom-built tables and benches and teaching workshops for children, Sievers' income is low enough to qualify for Medicaid, which means
it's paid for 100%.
The procrastination and indifference toward health insurance among young, healthy people like Sievers means fewer of them have signed up for health care since the marketplace opened. But they're vital for making the state and federal health exchanges work. Healthcare officials across the nation want young adults to sign up because they are key to keeping premiums low and steady. Young people tend to be healthier and can help balance the costs of older people who need more medical attention. That's why Kentucky Health Benefit Exchange Executive Director Carrie Banahan and others at the State Cabinet for Health and Family Services are reaching out to young invincibles any way they can.
Miss Pinewood, recently many of the local restaurants have changed their small size option to a whopping 64 ounces.
That's correct, and it's great for the consumer.
For example, if you live in Kentucky and have spent much time streaming shows like Parks and Recreation on Hulu, you've probably seen an ad with smiling, stylized characters that sounds like this.
Great news. Quality health insurance for everyone is here. And Connect, Kentucky's healthcare connection.
Banahan says the ad is part of an online campaign to reach young uninsured people.
We recently got some results back from Hulu and we're very excited that we had a 95% view rate. I mean, that's super fabulous.
In Kentucky, more than 52,000 young adults between 18 and 34 make up nearly a third of all Connect enrollees as of January 17th. But almost 44,000 of those young enrollees are Medicaid eligible, with the remaining almost 8,600 signing up for other plans. Kentucky Cabinet for Health and Family Services spokesperson Gwenda Bond says the department had no goal for young invincibles.
We've been happy with our enrollment so far.
The Kaiser Family Foundation reports of all people signing up through exchanges, 40% need to be young invincibles to cover costs. The foundation found that number by finding the percentage of young invincibles in the individual market, which includes those who are uninsured or buying their own insurance and don't qualify for Medicaid. Young Kentuckians who don't qualify for Medicaid make up nearly 22% of Connect enrollees in the individual market. Bond says since this is the first year for Connect signups, she's not concerned.
We see this as a multi-year process, and that's how the Affordable Care Act was designed. I think sometimes there's this implication in some of the reporting that, oh, we're doomed if we don't get all these people in the first year. But that was never really the overarching plan.
Banahan says she expects more young adults to sign up in coming years as fines increase for not having health insurance.
It's $95 per member per household or 1% of income, whichever is greater this year. And it increases to the point where it's going to hurt, you know, and it's going to make people say, well, it's cheaper to get coverage.
Kentucky isn't alone in its smaller percentage of young invincibles signing up. Nationally, 24% of enrollees in state and federal exchanges are young invincibles. But the federal exchange saw an eightfold increase in young adults signing up during December, and Connect could also see an increase as the March open enrollment deadline nears. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Whitney Jones.
Bills affecting pregnant women were debated in both the Kentucky and West Virginia legislatures this past week. The Kentucky Senate passed a bill that would require ultrasounds for women seeking abortions. Kentucky Public Radio's Jonathan Meador reports.
According to the reproductive rights nonprofit Guttmacher Institute, 88% of abortions occur during the first 12 weeks of pregnancy. During that time, fetuses are so small that doctors will employ transvaginal probes to conduct an internal ultrasound. Senator Whitney Westerfield, the bill's sponsor, acknowledges that such a procedure could be traumatizing.
I think it probably would be traumatic, but I don't know if those numbers are accurate. I don't know where that data is coming from, so I can't say I know, but I know that the bill doesn't require any particular method.
Westerfield says this is the 10th year such a bill has cleared the Senate, only to routinely die in the democratically controlled House. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Jonathan Meador.
Meanwhile, in West Virginia, the House passed a bill known as the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act. It's intended to prevent discrimination against pregnant women in the workplace. However, as West Virginia Public Radio's Aaron Payne reports, some House members tried to add some additional provisions.
The Pregnant Workers Fairness Act allows employees to request an accessible work site, modified duties, and modified work schedule as long as these accommodations do not place an undue hardship on the employer. It also bars employers from denying qualified job applicants because they would be required to make reasonable accommodations. The House rejected an amendment proposed by Delegate Michael Folk to expand the definition of person to include the unborn fetus. The chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Tim Manchin, said the well-being of the fetus is already covered in the act, and additional terminology would create confusion on who could submit a claim based on the welfare of the child. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Aaron Payne in Charleston.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. The chemical spill in the Elk River near Charleston, West Virginia, that contaminated drinking water in 9 counties, continues to be a hot topic for discussion. This past week, a U.S. Senate subcommittee and state legislative committee each had hearings, and this coming Monday, the U.S. Transportation and Infrastructure Committee will conduct a field hearing in Charleston. The West Virginia Senate is urging President Obama and Congress to take measures preventing future chemical spills and to analyze the effects of the chemical that spilled into the Elk River, crude MCHM, on human health and the environment. West Virginia Public Radio's Ashton Mara has more.
The resolution asks the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Environmental Protection Agency to study the chemical that spilled into the Elk River last month. It says the chemical's short-term and long-term health effects on people and the environment have not been determined. The resolution also points out that accurate data about the chemical's makeup remains unavailable. The Senate also asks Congress to direct the Federal Emergency Management Agency to continue to provide water in affected areas of West Virginia. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Charleston.
In the meantime, the companies involved and public officials have been repeatedly questioned about how they've handled the situation, whether testing has been adequate, and whether the public has been well protected. As West Virginia Public Radio's Dave Mistich reports, officials from the Centers for Disease Control and U.S. Environmental Protection Agency joined Governor Earl Ray Tomlin and others to address some of these concerns.
Like you in this room and all the 300,000 West Virginians, I am frustrated and angry. I share your concerns about the water crisis, as does my team here in West Virginia, the national experts we have depended upon for guidance, and the federal partners who are standing with me today.
The governor and federal officials updated the public on the current status of ongoing efforts following the January 9th chemical spill. Dr. Tanja Popovic of the CDC reiterated there's currently no information available on the effect of MCHM on humans, but says scientists at the agency came up with the 1 parts per million threshold of the chemical in the water by converting research on animals and applying that information to sensitive populations.
To us, our scientific experts have taken a safety blanket of a factor of 1,000 to calculate how much, what levels in the water would be protective and not cause harm.
Popovic says West Virginia health officials are currently analyzing data about health symptoms reported after exposure to the spill and said symptoms reported were generally mild due to short-term exposure. She said the CDC doesn't attribute any adverse health effects to the spill. Popovic also noted their recommendations do not deem the water safe, but rather acceptable for use, and that the agency has no plans to monitor the population affected. EPA Region 3 Administrator Sean Garvin says members of his agency have been on the ground in West Virginia since the morning after the spill and have been acting in an assisting capacity.
EPA can confirm today that the spill site is stabilized. Work is underway to dismantle and empty all the tanks. West Virginia American Water Company sampling results remain at non-detect for lower parts per or at lower parts per billion levels. In other words, at orders of magnitude below the health risk levels recommended by CDC for MCHM and PPH.
EPA. With many residents complaining of a licorice smell persisting in the water, Bill Regato, the EPA's drinking water branch chief, says his agency is looking at studies done on what types of chemicals would leave a residue in water pipes. He says he doesn't believe the chemicals involved in the January 9th spill would adhere to the pipes of homes and businesses that have been properly flushed.
Chemicals with low partition coefficients would most likely not adhere to piping. The two chemicals that are involved here, MCMH and PPH, have very low partition coefficients. So it's anticipated that it would not leave a residual, but it's an issue we need to look at.
Argato says the studies they're examining do not provide information on the specific chemicals involved in the Charleston spill. Yet reporters at the briefing continued to ask about testing in homes as a means to calm continued concerns of the public. Governor Tomlin responded with the following.
Well, once again, we'll go back to what the scientists have said, or the experts have said. We will continue to rely upon the testing that's done out there, both at West Virginia American and around the affected area at the testing at the 10 parts per billion. Right now, there are no plans to go into 100,000 customers' homes to take individual samples.
However, yesterday evening, Tomlin announced via Twitter that his team was exploring options for home testing. And spokesperson Amy Goodwin confirmed it is something the governor's office has discussed and will continue to examine. Goodwin says Tomlin's office is developing a plan of action, considering the best strategy, as well as mapping and issues related to going into people's homes. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Dave Mistich in Charleston.
Donations for another West Virginia water crisis are pouring in from all across the country. Residents in a community in Wyoming County have been purchasing drinking water since September. And as West Virginia Public Radio's Jessica Lilly reports, it's not clear when that will end.
Hey, that's much better. This is what...
Herndon Consolidated Principal Virginia Lusk is showing public service officials the current condition of the water in the school. On this day, the water is a pale yellow, but the color varies.
It had been, darker, like Coke or coffee or something at one point.
The system is owned by Alpoca Water Works, a small, locally owned company with limited resources. Residents in Bud, Alpoca, and the school will eventually be serviced by the Eastern Wyoming County PSD when the district can provide the work. For now, Logan PSD General Manager William Baisden says his district has worked to rehab the filter, installed 3 flush valves, and other things to improve the quality.
We also
started feeding potassium permanganate and chlorine the way that it used to be fed when the previous operator operated. There's a lot of sediment in the line. There's a lot of red water coming from the lines, from the sediment that's breaking loose in the lines is what we're thinking. From what I've seen, the water is starting to clear up, but it's just not quick enough to my satisfaction. So we're going to try a couple different methods or alternatives to try to get it even clearer than it is now.
Basin says according to the health department tests, the water is not contaminated.
We bacteria tested the water. It's passed the bacteria, testing. There is an acceptable chlorine residual in the water at all times now. You know, we're flushing daily. We're backwashing the filter the way that it's supposed to be backwashed. So what we're coming up with now is just, it seems to be sediment breaking loose in the older lines, and that seems to be the biggest problem right now. We're also kind of monitoring the iron content in the water, which seems to be fairly acceptable.
Basin says one of the biggest problems with the system is simply age.
There's, many challenges of operating these old systems, and it's just, mainly age of the systems, and, it's just time for them to be replaced. Because most of them were put in, back 50, 60, 70 years ago.
Still, the boil water advisory remains in effect. Students at Herndon Consolidated continue to use plastic silverware and Alpoca, and Bud residents purchase bottled drinking water and are limited to washing clothes on the days when the water is clear enough that it won't ruin their clothes. But since our first story aired a few weeks ago, groups across the country have reached out to help carry the financial burden that residents have carried for months.
And this phone rings all the time. People, wanting to collect water and donate water from different states, far away.
Virginia Lusk says so far water has been delivered from groups in New Jersey, North Carolina, and Michigan, as well as the church in Mercer County and Norfolk Southern Corporation. The water is available at the school for pickup almost any time, and some is even being delivered on doorsteps.
The water's heavy, and it's difficult for older people, and, a lot of older people don't drive or whatever. And so I've got one of my parents here. She just takes it and sets it on people's porches, and she had sent me a message last night, and she said, I thought one lady was going to cry when I put that water on her porch or took it to her. And, I mean, it is just amazing, how much support and how good people have been to us.
The bad water has even caught the attention of Governor Earl Ray Tomlin. Wyoming County Emergency Service Director Dean Meadow says the National Guard visited the school last week to assess the situation and see if their presence was needed. But Meadow says it's not an emergency situation.
We don't want to sound unsympathetic to the people in Bud. We're very sympathetic and we can do all we can. And I'm very appreciative that the attention that they're getting. But to put them in an emergency situation where the state starts putting in water, who's going to bear that expense? And where does that stop when other communities come involved?
Meadow says the community still has access to water.
And so it's difficult for a state to set a precedent by looking at a community that has bad water and start shipping them in water, because the community down the road may say, hey, our water's bad too. It may not be as bad as Bud's, but they say, we have to buy our drinking water, so what kind of precedent are you going to set, and where's that expense going to come? So it's a very difficult situation.
In the meantime, Principal Virginia Lusk says the school will continue to accept donations for the community until the boil water advisory is lifted.
We just keep hoping. We thought it was going to be over. We thought when they could flush those lines that it would be over, and then that's been a slower process.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jessica Lilly in Bud.
All these problems have drawn attention to the complicated issue of water quality, what can impact it, how you test it, and what you might find. West Virginia Public Radio's Glennis Board spoke with an environmental scientist to bring us the Cliff Notes on water quality testing.
Water. It flows through our very blood, carrying oxygen and nutrients to cells. It flushes waste from our bodies, cushions our joints, and allows us to digest and absorb food. The average adult human body is about 60% water. Perhaps it's not surprising, then, that so many are still offended and disturbed by the water crisis in the Kanawha Valley. Kanawha, which, by the way, means waterway. It's been about 2.5 weeks since communities have been given the all-clear to trust their tap water for everything from drinking and cooking to washing their babies. Still, due to questionable industrial accountability, confidence is far from restored. Environmental scientist and licensed remediation specialist Mark Glass says we live in a world where water concerns aren't far from anyone's mind. More and more people are reaching out and into their own pocketbooks to test to see if something is in the water.
I think maybe more so than in the past, there's a little lack of confidence that somebody's out there collecting that information on their behalf, or at least there's less faith in that system in the past. So there's a lot of people just want to get that information.
Glass says in the wake of significant oil and gas developments in the state, there have been equally significant rises in interest in water quality testing. There are, of course, water analysis test kits and multiple laboratories equipped for such investigations. But Glass says it's important to note that test results are defensible to degrees. The state of West Virginia, for example, will only accept data and information about water quality prepared and tested by state-certified labs.
So you have to start out like, what do I need to know? What's the question I'm trying to answer? And what level of quality does my data need to be? Now, okay. If I just wanted to know just for my own personal thing, you know, hey, I've got some kids that are at home and they're drinking out of this tap water. I want to be able to sleep at night and think it's good. I don't need to prove that to anybody else. I need to prove it to me. So I can take a sample and collect that and get a number. So that's one use of the information, and it would be fairly inexpensive to get some basic information that way.
So what kind of contamination is most concerning? Hands down, Glass and many experts agree, you got to watch out for poo.
Like bacterial contamination, fecal coliforms, things like that. That can happen from septic tanks getting into groundwater. It can happen from surface water getting into your groundwater. It can happen from a mouse or insects getting access into your well water. There's lots of ways that can happen. So you want to test for that. You also want to test for some of the basic nutrients that can also indicate that.
Glass explains the next tier up after that is testing for metals. He says groundwater flows through geology and inevitably comes in contact with metals. Some, like iron or calcium, pose smaller risks, and some, like arsenic or barium, are only safe in low concentrations. And then there are general chemistry parameters to consider, like pH, conductivity, total dissolved solids, and total suspended solids.
And then I think the next most important thing is all of the ions, you know, the bromide, chloride, fluoride. Those can tell you a lot, sulfate, about not only the chemistry of your water, but what might be influencing your water. And those are easier to monitor over time.
Glass says it's getting easier to pick out influences from certain types of industries and waste.
During at least the oil, gas, and gas extraction process, we bring up a lot of geology from much deeper than we normally have it. You know, so that's where the radionuclides, we're bringing up some radium-bearing geology, and we're maybe even some of the broader volatile organic compounds and semi-volatile organic compounds, you know, benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, xylenes, and then into the semi-volatiles like naphthalene, which can come from both natural and man-made sources. Regardless, we want to limit our exposure to those, and we certainly want to know if they're in a drinking water source.
From there, it really becomes a question of managing costs based on risk. So basically, you could probably spend as much money as you want testing your water. If you're digging your own well, there's a certain amount of testing that's obligatory. Or if you're within piping distance, you can drink city water and let your taxes pay for testing instead.
Yeah, so public water supplies are pretty well regulated. I know that's hard to understand or believe in the light of, you know, the freedom industry spill and the impacts there, and that's certainly faith-shaking, but they are.
Glass explains that these utilities have the ability and obligation to test their water and continuously monitor the supply for various contaminants. Moreover, they publicly report findings. unlike, say, bottled water companies. In fact, these rules and regulations set by Congress in the Safe Drinking Water Act are all but absent for the bottled water industry, which, unlike utilities, is regulated by the Food and Drug Administration.
Plus, there's questions about the containers that bottled water is even stored in. You know, are we having exposure to plastics that's more and, you know, some of the constituents of plastics and stuff like that. So plus it produces a lot of waste. So I'm a huge fan of public water supply systems for energy efficiency, for probably for safety, you know, and I think that's where we should put our focus if we're worried about having good water.
What are the cheapest and easiest actions that individuals can take to personally safeguard? Carbon filters. Perhaps, ironically, coal is nature's carbon filter. So water percolating through West Virginia's coal-filled mountains could be some of the more pristine sourced water in the world. In the meantime, though, Glass says using carbon filters gives you the best bang for your buck.
It's a real easy thing to do, is that'll get any organic pollutants or any carbon-based pollutants out of your water. You know, I'm going to assume that if they're coming from a public water supply, they're not at a really dense or high concentration. So low concentrations of those things should not come through a public water supply. But if they did, you can be pretty confident that any organic thing would be caught by a carbon filter.
One other affordable step you could consider is getting your scientist on. Monitor your own tap water's conductivity and pH regularly and keep notes. Any major fluctuations could be a red flag that there's something in the water. Obviously, there are other water contamination issues that we probably should address, like disinfection byproducts and the growing threat of emerging contaminants we're just becoming aware of. But that, as we say, is another story. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. In 2010, Pennsylvania's Rendell administration launched a multi-million dollar program to monitor how Marcellus Shale natural gas drilling is affecting public forests. At that time, it was touted as one of the most aggressive monitoring programs by a public agency in the nation. As State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Kusick reports, 4 years and $8 million later, the Corbett administration refuses to release any of the findings.
The Marcellus monitoring report, it's way long overdue.
That's Dick Martin of the Pennsylvania Forest Coalition. He's been asking a lot of questions about gas drilling in state forests, but not getting many answers.
If you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And we need that data as a baseline in order to find out the effects.
The agency charged with managing state forests is the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. 4 years ago, John Quigley headed DCNR under former Governor Ed Rendell, a Democrat. He helped launch the Marcellus Forest Monitoring Program and managed to secure 18 new positions and a $2 million a year budget.
The focus was to annually generate a set of data that not only DCNR could analyze, but the academic community and the peer review process could have access to, so that we could collaboratively develop a full understanding of the impacts.
Quigley may have hoped for annual reports, but he left DCNR with the change in administrations shortly after developing the program. Under Governor Corbett, the agency says it has taken them 4 years to staff up the monitoring program and develop protocols. Dan Devlin heads DCNR's Bureau of Forestry.
Anytime you do something for the first time, it takes a little bit of time to get it and pull it all together, and that's what we're trying to do this particular time.
Devlin says the monitoring report will document the many ways gas drilling is affecting forests.
Whether it's noise, whether it's eliminating trees, whether it's new road construction, whatever. So from our perspective, we'd like to minimize that disturbance to the greatest extent possible.
Jim Grace is a Penn State professor of forestry who chairs DCNR's Natural Gas Advisory Committee. He says he doesn't believe there's been any kind of attempt to slow walk or suppress the monitoring process.
So I think being that it's the first one, it's occurring a little slower than some would hope, but hopefully it's well underway and we'll have it soon.
In the meantime, Dick Martin of the Forest Coalition says DCNR did recently meet with environmental groups to discuss the program, but he's been trying to get the agency to offer up more information.
Transparency from the agency would be enhanced if they would release some of the raw data and information that we have requested.
The department also recently denied a right-to-know request by State Impact Pennsylvania seeking more information about the monitoring program. A DCNR spokeswoman says the initial report will be published within a few months. Marie Cusick, State Impact Pennsylvania.
State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia on a multimedia data-driven reporting project covering the Commonwealth's energy economy. How to regulate fracking has become a big debate in the gas fields in recent years, but regulating other types of oil and gas drilling in the region has proved challenging for a long time. Carnegie Mellon University professor Joel Tarr has been studying the history of natural gas drilling laws and says Pennsylvania could create tougher regulations at drilling sites. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant has more.
The advent of hydraulic fracturing has reignited natural gas drilling, but it's an old industry. It started in Pennsylvania back in the mid-1800s. CMU professor Joel Tarr says, like today, there were concerns about its safety then, too.
People assume for some reason there had been no regulations in the past. There have been regulations.
Tarr says Pennsylvania approved the first Natural Gas Act in 1885. It required that drilling companies plug up gas wells once they were tapped out. But he says it doesn't look like the law was actually observed. A few years later, in 1891, another law was passed to protect waterways from natural gas pollution. And after that, the state continued to pass laws.
So there's been some attention to this, but I think the problem has been that they haven't been enforced. They haven't paid enough attention to enforce it, provided the money or personnel to make sure that these environmental boundaries, if you can call it that, were not breached in some way, and that we're protecting our environment.
In 1884 and 85, there were a number of natural gas explosions in Pittsburgh, killing nearly 20 people. Tarr says an editorial in the Pittsburgh Daily Post at the time was headlined Death in the Streets. It said, quote, "Save in a state of war, we don't believe any large city in the world was ever in a more perilous situation than Pittsburgh is today, owing to the dangers of natural gas explosions." Tarr says energy companies then didn't know enough about how to distribute natural gas from well sites to homes and businesses in the city. He says there was
a lack of knowledge about it, the wrong kind of piping was used, the wrong kinds of joints.
These kinds of things still happen, but not nearly as often. People concerned about the explosions back then held protest meetings around Pittsburgh. As an environmental historian, Tarr wanted to find out more about the effects of natural gas drilling and usage in Pennsylvania.
So I went back to look at the literature, and there was no literature. Nobody had written about the environmental impact, the fact that we had dug about 450 to 500,000 oil and gas wells in Pennsylvania in the last 125 years.
Tarr says many of these wells still exist today and are called orphan wells.
We don't know where they are now. We don't know what they're doing. We don't know if they're leaking methane or are they creating other kinds of problems.
Those orphan wells have been implicated in some recent gas problems. In 2012, an old well site became a geyser, blowing water and methane gas 30 feet into the air for more than a week in Tioga County in northeast Pennsylvania. And in late 2010 and early 2011, two houses near Erie blew up. Investigators believe that methane may have migrated from deep underground, caused by seismic shifts of modern deep well drilling, and then old abandoned wells provided pathways for the gas to seep to the surface. Tarr says the state should learn from this, that the lack of enforced regulations in the early days of natural gas drilling can lead to long-term problems.
Those orphan wells are a legacy to a large extent from past drilling, and we have to avoid creating another legacy today from what's going on today.
But Tarr says the state isn't doing enough to regulate the natural gas industry today.
We just don't have the proper administrative structure and the proper laws in the state of Pennsylvania to deal with the magnitude of what we're doing right now in the state in regard to fracking.
Tarr worries about methane, water pollution, and possible health effects from today's higher-impact fracking techniques. He wants companies that dig wells held responsible for the environmental cleanup afterward. For some wells, especially those owned by smaller drilling companies, Pennsylvania requires a bond of $4,000 or less. Tarr says that's minuscule compared to the actual cost of cleanup, which can range up to $500,000 per well.
So that means there's an incentive for companies to come in to drill, to get some kind of bounty, and then to walk away, you see, and leaving us with this legacy.
Another legacy problem that leaves the air and water polluted, that's what environmental historian Joel Tarr wants Pennsylvania to avoid. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on Pennsylvania's environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. One central Kentucky community is using technology to further improvements in its neighborhoods. WEKU's Stu Johnson reports on the official startup of Code for America in Lexington.
Code for America is described as a nonpartisan organization founded to bring web industry professionals to work with cities to promote openness, participation, and efficiency in government. Lexington is one of 10 cities selected to participate in the project this year. Three technology fellows will spend the next 10 months coming up with specific plans to improve quality of life through more effective and interactive city government. Fellow Eric Swartz says the effort begins with getting a reading from citizens.
What we'll do here is do a lot of user research and try to understand what's going on in the city and talk with as many people as we can and get a sense of what people love and people think could be better and that sort of thing.
Fellow Lizzie Diamond says a project in San Francisco focused on developing a new app to alert food stamp recipients when their allotments were about to run out. Lexington Mayor Jim Gray says 28 local individuals, businesses, and foundations are contributing to the Code for America project. For WEKU News, I'm Stu Johnson.
The Appalachian Regional Commission turns 50 this year and has awarded a grant to analyze whether it's been successful. The $300,000 grant will allow the WVU Bureau of Business and Economic Research and its Regional Research Institute to work with the Center for Regional Economic Competitiveness based in Arlington, Virginia, to identify what economic development strategies have worked. A WVU news release says the project will analyze the impact several ARC programs have had on the economy in Appalachia and will examine socioeconomic trends in the region. Bureau Director John Deskin says the research will identify which economic strategies are most effective and which will help the ARC and other agencies design future programs. The researchers involved point out the results of the survey will be useful not only in Appalachia, but in other regions of the country. The results of the study are expected to be released in the fall. It's been a long, snowy, and icy winter across Appalachia, and for those willing to take on a little adventure, it's hard to beat snowshoeing. More than 5 million Americans step outside in old-school tennis racket style or newer metal and plastic snowshoes. The Allegheny Front's Ashley Murray joined novices to the sport, as well as Venture Outdoors trip leaders, as they clomped across Pennsylvania's Laurel Highlands.
The toe pick is for going downhill or uphill. It allows you to dig in, grab a hold of the snow. The next bigger cleat that you see right here is underneath the forefoot.
So I'm in Rockwood, PA, snowshoeing with about 20 people. It's a beginner snowshoeing trek, as they call it, snowshoeing 101. And we are just starting out on the trail.
My name's Tom Cosgrow. I'm an assistant trip leader on this trip. We are going to be walking around Camp Soul. We're just going to be doing a big loop around this lake. I'm thinking around two-ish miles. How you doing so far with the snowshoes?
I think I'm doing okay. Yeah, oh boy, just slid a little there. Yes, spoke too soon.
All right.
And what's your name?
Elizabeth Engelman. Call me Lizzie. In many situations, I'm Engelwoman. I'm a longtime Pittsburgh resident, and I'm a Southern gal from Florida. And for 32 years, I've hated winter and decided this year I'm going to like it. And practically broke my neck to get here today, worked till 3 this morning.
Oh my God.
But I wasn't going to miss this. And I'm hooked. It will be snowshoe for me forever.
Well, you look like a natural already.
Oh, thanks. Fake it till you make it. Well, I hope you're having fun.
I am. This is very fun.
Because this is a hoot.
So we're walking along the trail still. We're getting deeper into the woods. It's just really gorgeous, really quiet. The trees are covered in snow. The only sound you hear are just the quiet conversations of the participants on this hike.
In the snow, we want to look at the terrain. You'll see where the tree hump is. You'll see where the snow is covered to rock.
Can you talk about the appeal of snowshoeing? I mean, as far as I can tell so far, and this is only my first time, it seems like a pretty safe winter activity. I mean, I've been skiing once before, and it was pretty terrifying.
Well, you're talking about a sport that everybody can do. It's low impact. You can make it as aerobic as you want. It's up to you. You're not going to fall going 50 miles an hour. You know, our mission is to get people outside to enjoy the natural resources of the area. And that's what we're doing.
We're really beginner friendly, which is great. It gives people a way to get outside when, you know, maybe they'd be uncomfortable doing something. Like today, we had snowshoes for everybody. You know, you don't have to go and buy them and make a big purchase. You can just try it and see if it's something you like to do.
I'm Doreen.
Doreen what?
Karis. I've been wanting to try snowshoeing for a long time. My family skis. I'm unable to do that. I've got very arthritic knees. So I thought, well, I can walk. I should be able to do this. So my choices are sit around in the lodge, read a book, or go to the spa, or stay at home. This is much better than all of those things. Although the spa's a nice trip too.
And we are about to end the hike, but it is uphill to the car. So, yes, it is wearing me out. From Rockwood, PA, on a snowshoeing hike, I'm Ashley Murray for the Allegheny Front.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, WHYY in Philadelphia, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.